Welcome to the podcast of Hemisphere, the official journal of the European Hematology Association. Hemisphere's podcast presents insightful, expert discussions about recent hematology publications. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles DeBock, and I'm a group leader here at the Children's Cancer Institute in Sydney, Australia, and one of the scientific editors for Hemisphere. So in our last episode, we were talking with Petya and Jörg, who are two of the three authors on a recent review article on metabolism and hematology. It turns out, though, that we had a lot more to talk about than we'd first planned on. And so I've broken this up into a part one and a part two. Welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles DeBock, and I'm your host. It goes without saying that cellular metabolism is essential for maintaining homeostasis, cell growth, and differentiation. It's probably also not so unexpected that changes in metabolism underpin malignant cell growth. What has changed, of course, is the rapid rise of different technologies that can accurately measure metabolic changes that can really provide a greater insight into the biology of both healthy cells and malignant cells. But for those of you who are new to the field of metabolism or have just discovered perhaps in your transcriptomic data that metabolic pathways are suddenly changed or highly enriched, you're probably wondering, what is the next logical step for me to follow up on at an experimental level? So I am very delighted today to be joined by Jörg Boucher from the Max Planck Institute of Immunobiology and Epigenetics, Freiburg in Germany, and Petya Apostolova from the Department of Biomedicine, University Hospital Basel, Switzerland, who are co-authors on a new review published in Hemisphere entitled Metabolism and Hematology, Technological Advances Open New Perspectives on Disease Biology and Treatment. And so welcome to you both to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So my first question is going to be very broad and follows my earlier point that metabolism is crucial for normal cellular growth and that this changes during malignancy. Perhaps you can elaborate on why you're both so very interested in studying metabolism and why this is such an exciting time to be in the metabolism space.
Hello from my side, and thank you for inviting us to speak on the podcast. To be honest, for a very long time, I didn't even realize that I was doing metabolism research. I started as a medical student doing my doctoral thesis around 2010, and my work back then focused on these two enzymes, CD39 and CD73, and we studied their role in stem cell transplant immunity, or specifically in graft-versus-host disease. And so what CD39 and CD73 do is that they degrade extracellular ATP to AMP and to adenosine. These enzymes are now well explored in the context of T-cell exhaustion, and there are even some drugs targeting adenosine signaling. But back then, we didn't think about this as metabolism research. We saw it more as research on immunosuppressive signaling, and this shows us how closely cellular metabolism and signaling are actually intertwined. And this is one of the reasons why I'm really excited about metabolism. Later on in my postdoctoral work, I joined Erica Pierce's lab, a lab that is really expert in immunometabolism, and we dive really deep into lipid metabolism in CD8 T cells. And so throughout the development of my research interest, I always found it crazy and fascinating at the same time that we might not see differences in gene or protein expression related to such pathways, but a seemingly small thing in the metabolism can have a huge effect on biology of cells. And I believe this is true for immune cells and also for healthy blood cells, for blood cancers. And this is what makes me really excited about metabolism, to get to the small functional differences that have a huge impact on cell phenotype. And one other reason why it is amazing to be in the metabolism space is also because of the advantage because of the advances in technology. This is what motivated us to write this review article. And I think that with new metabolism technologies, we can really uncover biological aspects that were not known before. And this is where I'm also so happy to have teamed up with Jörg, who is the real expert on the technological side.
Well, thank you. Very charming. And thanks for having me here in this podcast too. As Petya has said, I come from the metabolism field, which means my background is really biochemical engineering / applied biology. And so that means initially I worked with yeast and bacteria a lot, and I worried about culture conditions and how to make the cultures grow and do produce some valuable metabolite of interest. But in my mind, from there, it's really only a small step towards cancer metabolism and immunometabolism, because what brings the two together is that we think about cellular metabolism in order to then fix something or produce something on the whole, like organism level or culture level. So how to bring in those internal and external factors of the cell to understand the cells with some goal in mind. Having said that, at some stage, I realized I really like to have a strong technology focus in my work. I like to play with the fancy machines. And I found that mass spectrometry is just such a versatile tool to study intracellular metabolites. And you can apply it to so many different research questions, from biochemical engineering, cancer metabolism, immunometabolism, just a few examples from my work. But there are many others out there. And why you can actually unify that, I think about, is quite cool, is that the primary metabolism that the cells do is actually highly conserved across all kingdoms of life. That means the metabolites that occur in typical pathways, they are the very same. So it means we can use the same mass spec assays on samples from very different backgrounds. And the fundamental regulatory mechanism in metabolism are often also transferable across species. So that's why I think it's no contradiction to be talking in this podcast, even though my background is really metabolism.
So for those of us who are not watching this on YouTube and listening to this on your favorite podcast platform, what the listeners won't realize is that behind Jörg is this huge poster of every single metabolism pathway and biochemical pathway, which I think if you're an undergraduate back in the day, you would have had to learn. And I'm looking at that and I can see that the enthusiasm for metabolism is actually exemplified in this amazing poster behind you, which, as you said, is up there actually for legitimate reasons, because you interrogate it on a daily basis. And I find it interesting, as you said, that you started in yeast and you can transpose that all the way to humans and what you can learn from that, which is really important for fundamental biology, you know, that we can still use these basic tools and then translate that to higher order organisms. And in fact, you've already mentioned mass spectrometry, and your review does focus on multiple technological innovations in the metabolism field that have been able to make these in-depth metabolic analysis more broadly accessible. And even in my own work, we have to dabble in that as well, the mass spec. So perhaps you could elaborate a bit further on how these advancements have genuinely reshaped our ability to probe metabolism, maybe at the cellular level. Petya, you mentioned in 2010, you already started doing research, but it wasn't called metabolism. So how have things changed?
Maybe I can come back to the poster for a second, because, you know, this shows the part of metabolism that we know about. What is coming more obvious in the field, the more we investigate metabolism and the better the machines get, that there's more to it. You know, people discover new metabolic reactions, even in like super well-studied organisms like E. coli or humans. It's the part we know, but we know that there's so much more out there. To me, that feels like, you know, a world map from medieval times. And when you compare that to nowadays world maps, so this is like the medieval times. And, you know, we're moving on from there. The development we've seen over the last years, and it's not only in mass spec, it also applies to other technologies. They come in mainly three fields. They come in sensitivity, comes in resolution, and in throughput. That's a kind of generic terms. What does it really mean for our research? Better sensitivity can come both from better sample prep protocols, and it can also come from new detectors, so new machines. And I think we've seen an improvement of 1 to 2 orders of magnitude over the last 10 years across different technologies. And what it actually allows us to do in the lab is that we can either work with more limited sample material, like, for example, less body fluid, less cells that we need. And so to give you an example from our own work, we now routinely work with as little as 1,000 to 5,000 cells. So this allows us to work with the very few hematopoietic stem cells that we recover, for example, from the leftover filters of a bone marrow transplantation, or that we can recover from a single mouse. So this is really cool, because now you can use the more defined but smaller population and still do research on it. However, of course, there's also material where you have, when you're not limited, like body fluids or cultured cells, and there more sensitivity helps you to dig even deeper into the samples and just discover more metabolites, get a more complete picture. Coming to better resolution, that means generally speaking, you can see more parameters separately that were kind of blurred before. It's in a way, if you can imagine that to development, the camera in your phone took over the last 10 years, that now the pictures are just sharper and look better. In mass spec, that means we can now separate compounds where we could only see the sum of those compounds in the past. Or for example, in flow cytometry, it means we can now analyze more cell types simultaneously or more subtypes from a single sample than we could before. And lastly, to come to better throughput, that means just more throughput. That means we, with the same investment of time and money, we can just do more analyses. So that means we can get better statistical power. We can therefore get more confidence in the findings or even see more subtle differences, which in metabolism still can be very meaningful. And the other thing that this has enabled is the large population studies. If you look at stuff like the UK Biobank studies, where they have hundreds of thousands of samples, you need quite a bit of throughput to measure that and to get then comparable data, not only in the well-controlled model system, but also in the real-world settings.
I can add something. So if I can go back to my example of CE39 and CE73 and adenosine signaling, at that time I remember well there wasn't even one already fluorochrome coupled flow antibody for CE73, so I had to do this two-step protocol with primary and secondary antibody. And now we are kind of fast forward 15 years, you can measure tiny amounts of adenosine that have been released by hematopoietic stem cells in the culture or by some way affect standby cells. And so I think that not only in mass spec, but also in all the other technologies, protein level, also functional technologies that we're also writing about in our review, there have really been huge advances that help us to see and understand biology we were not able to see before.
It reminds me about 10 years ago, I was speaking to Professor Charles Mulligan from St. Jude, and he presented this great story of RNA sequencing. And I asked him, is that it? Can we find anything else? Like we're doing transcriptomic data quite a lot. And he said, oh, look, we're just scratching the surface. And that always held with me because now in the last 15 years, yes, we have more throughput, we can access more samples, etc. And it really was scratching the surface then. And I imagine now we're at this new wave again of metabolism with the technology that we are really only scratching the surface of where we actually should be and will be again. So maybe I can segue from that, because one of the technologies that maybe many of our listeners are familiar with is the Seahorse Analyzer. Can you give us a quick update on its current place in the field, given all these technologic advantage and where it sits in the state of the art?
Yes. So the Seahorse assay was indeed one of the early big breakthroughs in the technology. Why is that? It allows us to look at dynamic metabolic features in real time. So basically, for those who might not be familiar with it, in the Seahorse assay, we immobilize cells in a single cell layer on the bottom of a special 96 well plate. We put these cells in media, which is free of buffering agents, so that changes in pH, for example, can be measured. And then we use a proprietary cartridge with 4 ports. And what these ports allow us to do is to inject at a specific time point, inject a certain drug, maybe a metabolic inhibitor, to all of the wells in the plate, or also a combination of drugs. And so the plate together with the cartridge is placed in the instrument, and then changes in the pH and in the oxygen levels can be measured for each individual well. What this does is that it makes it possible for us to see how the cells react to the drugs that get injected. It is also possible to tailor these drugs to the specific question that we have in mind. So if we specifically want to look at glycolysis, we might inject different drugs compared to if we're interested in looking at fatty acid oxidation. I would say the Seahorse assay is a versatile technology. Its big advantage in my eyes is that it allows us to monitor dynamic changes in real time. So we can really see what happens if we give a drug to the cells, what do they do with their metabolism. This made it a gold standard in the field. Now, recent developments of the Seahorse technology also allow us to reduce the number of cells that we need. They also allow us to probe 3D models, such as organoids or spheroids. And I think that this is really interesting.
Because one of the challenges has been with liquid, like hematopoietic cells, is that they are obviously they're in suspension rather than adherent. And so I know that that's something that you have to actually make them with cell tact stick to the bottom. But I didn't know you could do 3D bio organoids as well. That's fantastic.
These are some new developments. I have to say there are disadvantages. Like you say, for cells that are in suspension, you have to make them stick. I found that this might be tricky with some cell types, especially also with primary cells. Also, what is a big disadvantage, I would say, is that it lacks the single cell resolution. So we cannot say cells that have more and more of these properties have this metabolism. You only see a reflection of the bulk cells. It's a relatively high number that we need. So even with the newest improvements, I would say we need somewhere between 50 and 100,000 cells. It depends on the cell size, but we cannot get much information from 1,000 cells.
If I may add to that, one thing I really like about the technology, it's as you mentioned, it's very widespread in marine biological labs. And when then people observe some phenotypes there and then come to us because they want to look more closely to it, is when we do assay that we call stable isotope label tracing. We actually can often confirm what people have found in the seahorse assays, but additionally get some more fine-grained resolution about one pathway or the other. So it's really very nicely complementary. And it's actually a very nice entry point to get into metabolism research and then, you know, dig deeper.
I agree. And we also use it on a regular basis.
It's like the gateway drug. You start with a seahorse and before you know it, you want to do mass spec and other metabolomics. So maybe it's big seahorse speaking there, trying to get more scientists to run metabolic assays. You mentioned the fact that, you know, your number of cells and single cells, but one of the classic single cell instrumentation is flow cytometry. And I think you touched upon that in your review. I think you call it CENITH, which is like a flow cytometry based assay or analysis. Can you just elaborate a bit more on how the flow cytometer is also being used on metabolic measurements?
Yes. So there are different developments. The technique you just mentioned, CENITH, it's based on looking at protein translation. So basically the assumptions that the authors made or also very nicely showed is that energy metabolism is directly related to the rate of protein translations that our cells do. So the more energy that the cells have, the more protein translation they will do. And so by measuring puromycin incorporation as a measure of protein translation, we can get at the energetic state of the cell. This then, also the cell similarly to the seahorse, can get treated with metabolic inhibitors so that we can see, okay, if we, for example, inhibit mitochondrial respiration, how much protein synthesis does my cell do, meaning what is its energetic state. What is helpful about this technique is that then we can also combine it with our surface marker. Let's say I have PBMCs, all the possible cells. If we put those on the seahorse plate, we will get just a reflection of the total cell mixture. If we now do a flow cytometry based assay, we can have our markers like CD3, CD19, monocytic markers, and we can gate on these subpopulations in our flow cytometry to then assess the metabolic state of these individual cells. And so when we have these mixed cells where we cannot or do not want to separate each specific population, this is where flow cytometry assays give us more information. CENITH is one example. We can also measure mitochondrial mass by flow cytometry. We can measure reactive oxygen species. There are more and more dyes coming out there that kind of give us a bit of an idea of our cell's metabolism together with the cell phenotype.
So the seahorse and flow cytometers are the entry level. And then as part of the scientific vernacular, we've gone from transcriptomics to proteomics to genomics. And now I think you must have metabolomics. So I'm guessing that's the next level when you go from flow cytometer and the seahorse. So can you maybe, for the uninitiated listeners, maybe perhaps elaborate a little bit on what metabolomics is and what this actually means? Because I think you already mentioned the fact that you can then use your initial findings from the seahorse or flow to then go into isotopic labeling and mass spec. So perhaps I can start with you, Jurgor.
Happy to do so, but please do stop me in time because this is a topic I could talk about this for hours. So it's
we have a limit, so we'll see how we go. All right.
Okay, very good. So what is metabolomics? The word is composed of the start off with metabolism. So when people think about metabolism, a lot of people think about it on an organism level. So we as humans, or also our lab animals, they eat food, we obtain energy and building blocks from that, very evident if we eat too much and we gain weight. And the rest that we don't use ends up in the toilet. In a similar way, every single cell in our body also does this thing. It takes up nutrients, it creates energy, it creates building blocks, and it creates waste products. And when you look inside the cell, there's hundreds of biochemical reactions catalyzed by enzymes that do those interconversions. And we think of those as a network where the product of one reaction is the reactant of the next reactions. And those intermediates are being handed from one reaction to the other. That's what we call the metabolites. And metabolomics is then one step further which means that we not only look at one or a handful of metabolites, as people have been doing in classical biochemistry for decades, but we try to cover as much of metabolism as possible and to really get this system-level snapshot of the metabolic state of a cell. And to do that realistically, the most commonly used tool, I would say, is the combination of chromatographic separation and then detection in the mass spectrometer. There's all other technologies like NMR or direct mass spectrometry that are also being used, but I would say chromatography, either gas phase or liquid phase, together with mass spectrometry is really the one that's used the most. The chromatography gives us the separation by some physicochemical property of the metabolites, like, for example, their polarity or their hydrophobicity. And then we combine that with the mass spec, which is really an orthogonal method, which, as the name suggests, measures the mass. And we also get a signal intensity. And the signal intensity is a measure for the relative abundance. So we can compare the relative abundance of metabolites across different samples. So doing metabolomics is not only rewarding, as I think we have all now understood, but it also comes with some challenges. And those challenges are directly linked to the inherent properties of metabolites. So one of them is the very high turnover of metabolites. The turnover of metabolites is much faster than that of proteins or RNAs. So it can be more often than not in the order of seconds, which means when you go to the lab, there's quite a high risk of introducing sampling artifacts because sampling protocols take longer than just a few seconds.
What I always like to tell my students is if you're preparing your metabolomic samples, you cannot go for lunch in between. Don't let them sit on ice while you're doing some other things for a couple of hours.
Yeah, that's true. It's even like going from one lab to the other to do first the one step and then the second step of a protocol might be critical. So it's really, you have to be quick. And okay. The data gets better as people are more trained. So don't be put off if your first experiment is not quite as good as you was hoping it to be.
Right. If I can interrupt there, it does sound, though, if there's that much variability built into the experiments, that technical and biological replicates are a must because to get rigorous data out of your analysis after doing all the metabolomics. And if there's so much instability built into the system, how do you overcome that? Because you're saying, you know, this things only last a second and it's a snapshot in time. So in your processes, you already said you can't go for lunch, but how do you adjust for the inherent variability in the metabolomics processes then?
As you mentioned, doing replicates is a key thing. And then it's also about doing things reproducibly, about handling your samples in a very reproducible way. When you think about it, it's like when you have a plate full of samples and you have three steps in your process, rather, you know, do all three steps for every single sample rather than doing the first step for the whole plate and the second step for the whole plate and the third step for the whole plate. It's really annoying that you might have introduced artifacts. You want them to be as consistent as possible, to have everything as reproducible as possible, because we and others showed in the past that even in cases where we know we have introduced artifacts, we can show that we can still find meaningful biological differences. And I think this is what brings the study forward. And so this is, you know, a route that it's worth taking.
Petya, please, you have something more to add.
I just wanted to add, I think in the end, it also depends a bit on the starting material. We often see if we have, let's say, the cells grown in culture, we can really achieve very well reproducible replicates that you can compare really astonishingly well, I would say. And then, as with many other technologies, when you go in vivo, when we have maybe a material from animals or from people, there is more variability and there you also need more and more replicates to be confident about your data.
One last point on that in terms of variability. What about batch effects? Do you find that if you were going to set up repeats that you want to run everything on in terms of the batch effects for the machine that you use? Because I know in some basic proteomics, they'll say, okay, if you've got biological repeats, rather than run one on Monday, one on Wednesday, one on Friday, we might just go, okay, collect all your samples and we'll run them all and we'll kind of multiplex them on the same run. Is that the same for metabolomics, for mass spec as well, that you have to kind of be aware of that? Okay, what are the samples we want to compare and try and run them at the same time? Is that something to consider?
Absolutely. It just makes your life so much easier if you run all the samples that you want to compare in one go, if it's doable for the number of samples that you have. I earlier mentioned those very large population studies where, of course, this is not possible. But then again, then you have a lot of samples. So then there's established statistical methods to compensate for batch effects. But of course, those methods don't work if you have like one sample on Monday, one on Wednesday, and one on Friday. If you have 100 on Monday and 100 on Wednesday and 100 on Friday, then you can do those statistical corrections. But if you have three samples, rather collect them and run them the following week.
Good to know. Good to know. So I'm always thinking about optimizing my own workflows to make sure I get the most out of my own data. Actually, on that, the data side, when you're talking about the metabolomics, you're going to make a lot of data. You're going to generate a lot of data. I'm not going to touch upon it, but maybe you can just hint at the fact that once you have it and you have all this metabolomics data, how do you personally make sense of it? And for someone who comes to you and says, hey, this is something I want to compare, do you have to match the technology with the downstream informatics side of it as well? Or is that more straightforward once you have the data?
I think you do have to have the tailored downstream data analysis pipeline in place as well. It's because metabolites are inherently different from proteins and RNAs. You have to think about it as proteins and RNAs, they're all sequence-based. And you can, well, more or less match the proteins and the RNAs to the genome sequence. And therefore, you have some common basis that you can work with. And we don't have that in for metabolites. So the first thing is that identification of the signals is a challenge, because particularly if we do something we call non-targeted metabolomics, where we want to measure with the least bias as possible, we measure the identity very indirectly. We measure chromatographic time, which is a measure, for example, for polarity, and we measure mass. And if your resolution is good enough, then from this mass, you can deduce a sum formula. But the identity of a metabolite is, of course, more than the sum of the atoms it is composed of, but how those atoms are connected. We don't have a direct measure of that. So identification is a huge challenge that other omics don't have. If you look then at the basic statistics, what we and others do, it's like you do the same dimensionality reduction, the same kind of heat maps. The statistics is not so different, but there are some steps which are special.
But what I would say is special and still a bit like, it makes me more and more curious. Like Jörg says, you measure a lot of signals in mass spec and you can annotate names of metabolites only to a fraction of them. And this fraction is actually smaller than people might think. I would say maybe 80% of the signals that we have, we don't really know what metabolite is behind them. And I'm always so curious. Then you make your volcano plot and you see, oh, my most significantly regulated signals are not the ones that I can actually annotate to a name. So what are these? And I'm wondering, what do you think, Jörg? Are we going to get to a point where we can attach a name to most or all the signals that we get?
So with the technology as it is, unless there's like, you know, the very big throughput, that breakthrough that nobody has ever thought about before, I'm not sure. We, of course, can increase the number, but this comes at the cost of confidence. So we can already annotate many more, say, by just looking at the mass and from the mass estimating the sum formula and then going to a database like the Keck database or the HMDB database and just look up what metabolites are known which match that mass. We can do that, but of course, then we have very little evidence that the name we put there is actually correct. Unless, you know, for high confidence annotations, we need like a reference compound ideally for the very highest level of confidence. And then we're just, you know, we're limited by the catalog of the typical chemical vendors. If they don't have it, it's hard to have a reference compound unless you have a very good organic chemist collaborator who will synthesize it for it. But then, you know, also there, we mentioned that we have like thousands of signals, and then first you have to develop a hypothesis for those thousands of signals, and then you have someone to synthesize all those compounds. I don't think it's going to happen that soon. Instead of worrying about that there are so many signals which we don't know what it is, I think we should be happy for the ones which we can identify, and for the ones, even if we can't identify them, we can do something like a partial identification something. We can say, okay, this is probably a very polar compound, or this is probably a completely apolar compound that's rather be located in a membrane, for example. And from that, you know, with this partial information, we can use all those even unidentified signals to do statistical analyses and separate groups. And so it's not that like they're useless, it's just not as nice to work with them.
So it turned out that we had more to talk about with Petya and Jörg about metabolism than we'd initially anticipated. So we've decided to make this into a two-part series, a part one and a part two. This is part one. So please tune in soon for the second part of this podcast. In the meantime, do have a look at their review on the Hemisphere website, and I'll be back with part two.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hemisphere Podcast. All of Hemisphere's content is open access and can be found at www.hemispherejournal.com. We hope you will join us for future podcast episodes.
I will tell you now, I am not a metabolism expert, and I was just commenting to Jurg, the whole metabolism Krebs cycle, TCA cycle poster is giving me post-traumatic stress disorder flashbacks of my undergraduate learning of biochemistry and